For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, we're going to start a study of the Gospel of John, which I just love John. I'm calling the series The Intimate Gospel because that's really what it is, and for reasons that you'll see. That just, whereas the other three Gospels, which are called the Synoptic Gospels, are synopses or kind of chronologies of the life and teaching of Christ, which is super helpful, of course. It anchors Jesus in history and in time. The Gospel of John, while also being chronological, is also much more thematic in its orientation. And it just really takes the time to narrate these lengthy interactions, lengthy conversations with people who are far from God and who God is drawing near to himself. And so it's just really beautiful in that deeply personal sense. So we're going to study John 1, verses 1 to 18 tonight. And so to get ready, we should start at chapter 20, verse 30. Because like a good writer, John gives us like a thesis statement. He would do well in your grammar school English class because he's going to tell us right here what his gospel is about. And he says, many other signs Jesus performed. This is at the end of his ministry. And John is reflecting back. Many other signs Jesus performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But he says, these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And that's what the whole book is all about right there. There are three themes that are intimately weaved together in every chapter of this book. The first is the question, who is Jesus? And just he is going to reveal himself in a variety of ways, just like a prism and the different facets in a prism shooting out lights of different hues all over a screen. That's what the Gospel of John is. It's this incredible picture of who is Jesus? Where did he come from? What is he about? And importantly, what does it mean to relate to Jesus as the Christ or the Messiah? So every little piece of this gospel we read is going to put another little piece together of who is Jesus. And then secondly, he says and that through him you have life in his name. And so what is the life that Christ offers is a big question. And 70 times in this 21-chapter book, 70 times, John uses the word life to describe what God is bringing to people who respond to Jesus. And so we're going to talk a lot about the life of God through Christ. It's something that's just really sweet and really beautiful how that comes together in the context of these intimate narratives. And then third is this idea of belief. What does it look like to believe in Jesus? Because in every little piece of the narrative, we're going to get an understanding of who Jesus is. We're going to understand what kind of life he is offering. And then we're going to give by way of Jesus' teaching or an example of how he relates with people, we're going to get a picture of what does it really look like in real terms to believe in him. And so it's just a very simple gospel with a very simple theme that we're going to see over and over again. And so the simplicity of the Gospel of John is beautiful, but don't let it fool you, because while it is simple in its structure and simple in its aims, it is really deep in terms of the ideas that really pack out who is Jesus and what is the life that he offers and what does it look like to believe. And so it's one of those things, it's a great example of the scripture, which is shallow enough for a toddler to bathe in and deep enough for you to go and put on your scuba equipment and take that deep dive. And so we're going to be somewhere maybe in the middle. Anyway, there it is. We're going to look tonight at the prologue. This is John chapter 1. And he begins, ironically, I think, in a very abstract place and then moves, as we'll see next week, down into the very relational and very personal. So tonight we kind of begin with a broad and abstract kind of presentation. He says in verse 1, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it." Well, again, against the background of that little thesis statement that we talked about just a minute ago, you can see each of these elements also present in the paragraph that we've just read. In the beginning, it says, was the Word. The Word, of course, in this context is Jesus. And the Word is God. So there's who is Jesus? Well, we have a picture of that, and we're going to develop that here in a minute. Second is we have a picture of what is it that He has come to offer, the life that He had, which He says was the light of men. So we have a little bit of insight into that thing. And then lastly, what does it mean to respond in faith? Here John says that He has come from God and as God into a world to offer life. But those who are living in that, the very life that He offered don't comprehend it, have a problem in the area of their faith. And so those three elements are there. Let's break them down here tonight and take a look. Who is Jesus? Jesus is, He says, the Word. The beginning was the Word. And here, you know, if you've read through Genesis 1, the creation story, this is all sounding very familiar. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the same language, and very intentionally so, that John is using here to introduce his readers to Jesus. And what John is doing is he's basically drawing a connection between the Jesus in history that he's going to start describing after verse 18, starting in verse 19, and the transcendent God of creation, the God of Genesis. And the reason why Jesus is, or why John is doing that is because the audience to whom John is writing are mostly Gentiles. That is to say, they're not Jewish, although some are pretty clearly from the context of what's written. But the heart of it is really a Gentile audience that is not really all that familiar with the biblical idea that there is one personal God. And so John opens up his gospel the way that the Old Testament itself opens, with the very creation account itself. And he introduces Jesus in kind of odd language. In the beginning was the Word, he said. Why the strange and mysterious language? Why doesn't he just say, in the beginning there was Jesus? And Jesus was with God, and Jesus was God, and He created everything, like the Apostle Paul makes clear in Colossians chapter 1. But no, John's got to go with this other thing. He calls Him the Word. Why does he do that? Well, the reason is because he's creating common ground with his audience and connecting their worlds. He's writing to people, again, who don't have that basic framework. They don't understand the concept of one personal, infinite creator God. And so, but what they do understand is this concept called the Word. And in the way of thinking in the first century Roman world, the idea was that there was this thing that was translated the Word out of the Greek. The Word is Logos. And in the Stoic thinking of the first century Roman world, great minds of the Roman age, Cicero in the first century BC, Seneca in the first century AD. Seneca was a Stoic philosopher and a thinker. And between Cicero and Seneca, these are men who established the whole Roman legal tradition. These are men who were molding through their ideas a whole society. And the Stoics, like these men and others that would come after them, had this idea that there is an organizing principle in the universe And they didn't, they just referred to it as the Word or to the Logos. And so what John is doing in his gospel is saying, I know who that is. The organizing principle of the universe, it's the God of creation. And so that's why he does that. And there is a inherent in the people that John is writing to, just as there is all over the world, a search for transcendence that this passage really captures. It's the idea that yes, there is the physical world that we live in and the cause and effect kind of flow of nature and this type of thing, but surely we think to ourselves, surely there must be more than just the material order with the way that it functions according to the laws of nature. And so all over the world, in Greco-Roman thinking, the Greeks talked about what they called the prime mover, the one who's responsible for the existence of the universe. Or what Plato, centuries earlier, called the demiurge, this unknowable God that somehow brought the universe into being and is provident over it. In the Indian tradition and among Hindus, the idea is that there's an underlying unifying principle, and that's Brahman. We can't really know Brahman or say anything about Brahman, but we just know there has to be some kind of a basis for the order, the design, the sense of meaning that we all have that you just can't extract from a test tube or something like that. It doesn't grow on a petri dish. The Chinese call it the Tao, just this principle of reason that governs the flow of nature. In African religions, they call it the High God, the God who created and uniquely created humanity and then became bored and ran off, never to be seen again. And so they're consigned then to the worship of lesser gods, always wanting to really understand and grasp who is the one true God, but never able to relate to him in a direct way. Or, as the Buddhist tradition would have it, there is simply Om, which is the nameless principle that transcends all personality, all description, but is something that is responsible for why all things that exist are. And John is writing to people, sometimes it's hard for us to grasp in our context, but John is writing to people who are desperate to understand what is it that makes life matter. That everything that they look to, their gods, their philosophical tradition, the greatness of their empire, all of these things provided not to be a reliable and true foundation upon which to make sense of my own existence or the value or significance of anyone else. And so by the first century world, we know this from the literature of the time, is a great time of questioning and what is it? And the best that they could come up with for why anything matters at all is this Stoic idea that there is a logos, as some sort of a principle that reason brings us to, because we know that the world's not random and doesn't just happen. We see that that nature follows an orderly course. There's got to be something. And so just in that context, John is stepping forward with a deep and extremely important proposition. And he's saying, to your question, is there a basis for any kind of meaning or purpose in the cosmos or in your life? What is this thing that intuitively we sense has to explain the majesty, the symmetry, the beauty, the cohesion of nature and of our own bodies and life? And John says there is an answer to that question. And the answer to that question is Jesus of Nazareth, whom he's going to describe in his earthly context and we'll pick up next week. That's very important. The Logos, the Word, is the infinite, personal God of the Jewish scriptures who revealed himself in history in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And so John is basically starting with the assertion that he will later prove along a variety of lines that we'll discuss over the next few weeks, that in Jesus as the Logos, as God in human form, comes meaning, comes design, comes rationality, comes order. And there is a basis then to talk meaningfully about these things. And the Word, not only is this principle of symmetry and organization, but John says it is the very power of God's speech, that Jesus is the agent through whom God brings into existence all that is, the vastness of the universe. That is a galaxy many times bigger than the Milky Way. It is just a speck in the sands of our universe. It's amazing. I put it up here for one reason only, which is to say that the speech of God, the Word of God, has incredible power. He simply speaks, and the immensity that is this universe comes into being. Amazing. And lastly, and most importantly, for John's purposes, when he introduces us to the Word, he calls him not an it, not some impersonal force like the Tao, or the Logos, or the or the Brahman, or prime matter, or whatever it is that we try to understand. What is it? What is the thing that makes it all happen? John says it is he. It is him. It is the personal God of the Bible. And what we're saying here, and what John is saying, is that there is a personal origin for irreducibly personal beings. And this is, again, we're starting, I grant, from this kind of abstract place, but it's a critical place. He's saying that if you think about who you are, that there is transcendence in human nature. And we have to ask ourselves this question, well, where does that come from? There's a principle of all rational thinking that runs like this: like effects follow like causes. You see what I'm saying? Like effects follow from like causes. If I kick this thing, oh, my water spilled out. But I could have known that. Why? That's for you, Paco. How could I have known that? Well, because we live in a physical world in which a physical cause will produce a physical result. But again, there's more to what it means to be a you than just a mass bag of chemicals reacting under your skin. And so what are we saying here? That there is a cause to your being that is not reducible to mere nature, mere matter. There are other things. Consciousness cannot be explained by impersonal, unconscious molecular activity. Atoms bouncing around in a cell cannot produce an awareness that I am, or your awareness that you are, which is more pertinent for you. If all that we are is just reducible to the natural order, just nature alone, then all that what we are and all that what we do must follow the unalterable and prescribed laws of nature, right? There would be no exception to that. But we all recognize intuitively and clearly that we are people who have the freedom to make choices. Oh, we're influenced, of course, by our culture around us. We're influenced by our bodies. But we realize even when things are competing for our affections and competing for our decision-making, that we can make one choice over another. We're able to do that. That's not reducible to mere nature. We have the capacity for language. That's why the Stoics called the organizing principle the Word, because the Word is, words are rational. words are related to other words in a rational way that conveys meaning, and that we can communicate with one another. Reason and creativity operate out of people who have this transcendent element to their being. Moral awareness. Nature's not good or bad. Nature just is. You know, when one amoeba sucks the life out of another amoeba, we don't say genocide. We say chemical reaction. Right? When the aardvark inhales an entire ant colony, we don't shriek Holocaust, Holocaust. We say dinner time. Okay? Because that's how nature operates. It's not good or bad, it just is. But we realize within ourselves something very different, don't we? We realize that there is a whole moral framework to our thinking, and that we do clearly recognize principles of justice and things like that operating in human relationships and human society. Every human society that's ever existed has viewed fairly similar principles of how people ought to be treated. There are oughts in how we treat one another. There are no oughts in nature, but there are oughts in human behavior, and we realize that this speaks to our transcendence. We're meaning-driven, not instinct-driven. Animals are driven by instincts to reproduce, to eat. Well, that's about it. Humans are driven by other things. The desire to love, the desire to make of my life something that really matters, to make a contribution to somebody else, to make art, all manner of things. These are speaking of the inherent transcendent nature of humanity. Every culture knows these things. This is the point. Every culture knows these things. You know these things. But the sweet thing that John is impressing upon us as his readers is that the intuitive, obvious nature that we are this kind of person, and the realization that we could never extract who we are just simply out of the cause and effect flow of nature, speaks to the existence of an infinite that is outside of space and time, a personal God, namely the God who, in the language of the creation narrative itself to which John refers, uniquely creates humanity in his image. And that's the basis. And so this is where John is starting his gospel, from this very high and elevated place. And he's saying that all of our aspirations, all that sense of human dignity, of the value and meaning of our lives, these things have absolutely a basis in the God of the Hebrew Scriptures, who made himself known in the person of Christ. It just is a fact that we all seek transcendence. Everyone, we may not call it that, but we all seek transcendence in our lives. And just like the Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, he says, God has set eternity in their hearts. We realize that there is something that we seek that is more than the merely biological, merely instinctual, that we seek something that is real, that captures the personhood that we possess. It is something that comes out of the very image of God, and we can never extricate ourselves from it, but neither can we explain it. Neither can we explain it without reference to the one true God. And so our drives in our lives, the things that are pushing us for purpose and significance, we want our lives to count somehow. We may define that somewhat differently, but we all want our lives to have a purpose that it serves. We don't want to sit down at the end of the day in our old folks' home on our rocking chair and say to ourselves, well, it didn't matter one bit. Who cares? Nobody wants that. We all want to believe that our lives did serve a purpose, that they were significant, that we have a true sense of connectedness and belonging, that we are endowed with a sense of hope about my life and about my life after this life. We seek the transcendent need, really, of love. All of these things that are driving human beings. And John is just saying that, you know, my audience, there is some wonderful news. And the wonderful news is that all of these deep longings that you really do have come out of the fact that you are uniquely the image of God. And the story that I'm about to tell you is the story of how that infinite personal God has moved into space and time and has revealed himself personally to us, which answers this deep question then, how could you possibly know? How could you know the answer to what is the real basis for all of these things to which we aspire as human beings? And the answer is that true, even the most brilliant minds of the modern age and the ancient age could not reason their way to God. But God has chosen to enter into history and to reveal himself to humanity. That's the story of John. So John then, beginning with this lofty place, this important place, then begins to move downward very quickly. And in verse 9 it says, there was a true light which coming into the world now enlightens everyone. He was in the world and the world was made through him and the world did not know him. He came to his own and those who were his own did not receive him. But, he says, as many as did receive him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believed in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word, the cosmic Logos, the creator of all that is, the master and sovereign of the universe, John said. Remarkably, became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word made flesh. Revealed in history. He dwelled among us. It's the word in the Greek is the same word as for to pitch a tent. It is as though wherever we are, his tent, boom, right next door. He's with us in that sense. And this is why John says we saw his glory. We saw it. The unique nature of the Gospel of John is these super intimate conversations that Jesus has, starting in chapter 2 and just kind of working all the way through, where he's dealing with people who are dealing with life, and he's moving toward them, and he's revealing himself to them. And so this language is really intentional on John's part. He starts with this really abstract thing, and then he goes right down into the what you can... With your senses, what we saw, he says, we witnessed, or like he says in his letter, 1 John chapter 1, verse 1, he says, what was from the beginning, what we heard with our ears, what we saw with our eyes, what we looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. He's saying Christ is fully God. Absolutely fully God. The words used in the Old Testament for God are used in the narrative of John in relation to Jesus. Let there be no mistake about it. He is God in the absolute sense. But he is also made flesh and dwelt among us so that his disciples could hear, see, and touch the incarnate Word, the God himself. And so as we read through these narratives, we're going to find out how the God of glory, he says, the God of substance, of weight, how the God of glory relates to your dilemmas, your weaknesses, your pain, and at least in my case, foolishness. And there, I just love the way that the Gospel of John just takes that broad lens, and just whoever you think you are in society, maybe you are smart, rich, and moral. Well, Jesus has some words for you that you'll find in John chapter 3. It's great that you're smart, rich, and whatever you are. But you must be born again. That's something beyond your grasp. You may be one who has gone from one failed relationship to another. You may be sitting here tonight saying to yourself, I've given up on the whole idea that there is such a thing as love. It's just all parasitic relationship. That's all it is. And we've become cynical in our hearts. And we get to John chapter 4, and he's going to have a conversation with a woman who's right in that place. And he's going to call her to something that she could never have imagined. A well that God creates within that springs up into the freshness of eternal life. Something new, something real, something satisfying, something that makes relationships possible. And he's going to talk to down and outers who've lost everything, whose bodies are broken. And he's going to call on them to see. He's going to call on them to respond in faith to his healing touch. He's going to call on them to believe in his provision for their deepest needs that include the physical, but which tap much, much more deeply than that. And just in every dimension of life, in our loneliness, in our sinfulness, in our arrogance, in our lostness, in our alienation, in all of these things, Jesus has a very intimate conversational word for you. And I just love John for that reason. That's what that's all about. He says he's full of grace and truth. And so he is going to tell us the truth, and which is sometimes painful, so that we could treasure his grace. He wants to give us a gift. Grace means in the Greek, it's charis. It's a gift. Hey, it's the holiday season. It's appropriate for us to think about this. God has a gift that he wants to give to us. And what's that all about? What is his grace? It's very simple. He calls it two things, life and light. And between these two terms, life and light, they come together in the Gospel of John. They're referred to 85 times. I counted these things out. Because it's just in every single chapter, these ideas are there. What does he desperately want to give to you? He wants to give to you life. And he wants to give you light. Those are two things. Those are promises that he wants to make to us. Life, the core issue, according to the scriptures and according to the Gospel of John. You know, you think about religion, you think, what's that all about? Well, it's about being better. It's about being good, right? Well, John's like, yeah, well, that's, you know, whatever. We've kind of already lost at that court. So why don't we try the one that really matters, which is life and death. I came that you may have life. And that's what it's all about. And so he's offering life to all of these people. Here's just a smattering. I came that they may have life and have it in abundance. God doesn't want you to be in some dour, uptight place. He came that you would have an abundant life, that as the cosmic logos taking up residence in your heart, he has a purpose to work out for you, and it's beautiful, and that is appealing. It's all about life. He says, I am the resurrection and the life, and everyone who believes in me will live even if they die. So he speaks to life eternal, and the hope that we have that as he resurrected in space and time, so too will we resurrect to newness of life. And then simply put, he says in John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so there's life that's being offered. There's light, which is truth. That's a metaphor for enlightenment, which is truth. But not truth in just some kind of abstract sense. Truth in a relational sense. That we're going to do life together with the Logos. He's going to be involved in our lives. So all the eternal wisdom of God present in his Messiah, the Logos, the Son of God, is available to us as his children. He says, I'm the light of the world, and he who follows me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. You feel like you're in darkness? You ever felt that way? Confused at a deep level? Not just like, you know, what am I going to do tomorrow kind of lost, but I mean like, what's it all about kind of lost? Like, who gives about my life? What does it mean? Is there a purpose for me at all? Does anything that I do matter? You know, that is the answer to that. He is our light. Believe in the light, he says, so that you may become sons of the light. So God's going to be involved. He's going to be guiding us as we respond to him. And finally, he says that to the people that respond to him, he says he gives them the right, that's really interesting language, the right to become the children of God. So there's this intimate bond. It's not like God is out there in his starry heavens beyond all grasp, but he wants to come in and have a relationship with us that is a child-to-father relationship. And the Gospels use the term father scores of time in relation to God, and they call us to relate to God in this way because that's how he's loved us. He's loved us fully with all of the loyalty and sacrifice that is in him, and he has called us to himself to be his sons and daughters. And I just love the way Jesus kind of puts that whole family thing together in the last meal of his life that he shares with his disciples in John 17. He says he's praying to his father, and he says, I ask that they may be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. I in them, you in me, that they may be perfected in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me and love them even as you have loved me. So really the mark of a person who knows God is this love, this unifying love, this ability for all kinds of broken wills coming from different places to come together to put the needs and the interests of the other person above their own. And Jesus says, you know, when we do that, because we can do that, because we are God's children, and when we live that way, the world takes note. Because why? Because that's just not the way the world operates. The world's all about, what can I do for me? What about myself? How about doing me something? And the body of Christ, the Christian community, very different. Last point. He says, what does it look like to believe? What does believe really mean? If the questions we're asking is, what does it say about Jesus? What does Jesus offer, and what does it mean to believe? Those are the three. Those are the only three questions we're going to be asking for 21 weeks. So, you should not have problems on the comprehension end. What does it look like to believe? He says, as many as received him. To receive him. And that's beautiful language, because what Jesus is selling is not some sort of a doctrine that we sign off on. Yes, I believe that the earth is not the center of the universe. Okay? It's not like that. I mean, there are elements like that. There are true things that we're called to believe, but the heart of what God calls us to is not an intellectual grasp of certain propositions, but it is a heart's desire to receive him. He's offering a gift, the gift of grace, life in him. And he's calling on us not to believe that that's possible or that that's true, but he's calling on us to receive this gift. The gift doesn't mean anything unless you're willing to take it, open it, and put it on. Right? How bizarre would it be in just a few weeks, there's somebody that you love, you've been thinking about for hours, and you have a gift for them. And you present this gift to them, and they say to you, I believe that you have a gift for me. I believe this is a wonderful gift. Thank you so much for this gift. And then they set it aside. You'd be like, there's something missing here. I gave you something that I'm wanting you to receive. Not to believe that it actually exists. What we're talking about here is belief as humble personal trust in the costly generosity of God to the undeserving, which is you and me. I'm just sure in an environment like this, as there is every week, that we have our friends are coming, we're thinking through a faith that maybe we haven't thought about for many years. Things have come to our minds about, you know, yeah, it's the Christmas season, maybe I start thinking about God or whatever. And many of us here tonight perhaps even would consider ourselves to be Christians. We, if asked, you know, on some sort of a sheet, are you an atheist? No. Are you a Buddhist? No. Are you, you know, a humanist? No. Are you a whatever? Are you a Christian? Yeah, that's me. Why? Well, because I believe certain things about God or whatever. Well, that's good. That's real good. But the question that Jesus is putting out is not, do we believe that he is the Son of God, that he is the incarnate God, that he came into the world to die a death that you deserve so that you could have life in him? He's not asking, do you believe that those things are true? He's asking, have you received them into your life? That's a different thing. It's a decision. It's a movement of your will. It's saying, not only I believe that that gift is there, that's really awesome, but I thank you and I receive that gift and I open that gift and I identify with that gift. I want you, Jesus, the cosmic Logos, to enter into my life having forgiven me my sin. That's a choice that we make, to receive him. And so here we are. You know, maybe you are at this place that, where you realize, you know, that's not a decision I ever have remembered making in my life. I've always remembered believing, but I can't remember a single time where I've really come before God in this way and said, I want to receive the forgiveness and new life that comes through Christ. I'm prepared to acknowledge my unworthiness and my guilt and receive his complete forgiveness and new life simply as a gift from the hand of a generous God. Will you come into my life? Jesus said the same thing on the end of history, the same author, John, in the book of Revelation, in John chapter 3 and verse 20, and he said, I stand at the door of your heart and I'm knocking. And I will come in and to anyone who opens that door to me. And it's just that choice of, is he on the outside or is he on the inside? And you are the one who needs to open that door by faith. Come into my life. That's the Christian message. That's what it means to believe. What we're going to see then over these next several weeks now are just example after example after example in various ways. I'm asking you to read along. I'm really urging you to read ahead. And we're just going to ask these three questions. Who is Jesus? How does the life he offers relate to the life that you seek? Which is such a great question, and that's exactly what how we should read this thing. How does the life he offers relate to the life that you seek? You're going to identify yourself with the characters that make up this gospel, this great series of interviews with Jesus, and you're going to see in their longing your own longing, and Jesus is going to be speaking to you through that. And then lastly, we're going to ask, what does belief in Christ look like for you now? For you now. What does it look like for you now to believe that these things that Jesus is offering to you are true? So that's where we're going with our study. And I just, again, just feel that there's such a delight in this gospel. I just want to urge you to enter into the discussion, to do some thinking and reading even on your own. I just think that this is an awesome moment for God to use this great text of Scripture to speak to all of us and to really give us that sense of the privilege of knowing the incarnate Logos, to know Christ.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.